якраз казати конкретно Конгресу.
We must tell Congress that if Congress does not help Ukraine, Ukraine will lose the war. And we need to find a public format for this. If Ukraine loses the war, other states will be attacked. And that's a fact.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressing a pro-Ukrainian fundraising group over the weekend in translation there. His country is running low on munitions and air defense systems while Russia is increasing its aerial bombardment. Congress returns from spring break this week and funding Ukraine is at the top of the agenda. The issue could also topple House Speaker Mike Johnson. Far-right Republicans say they'll try to oust him if he pushes a new Ukraine aid package, or at least one far-right Republican says she will do that. Joining us now with the latest is Joan Grieve, senior political correspondent for The Guardian. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so the Senate has already passed a funding bill, $60 billion in military aid for Ukraine. So what is in a House bill, or what could be in a House bill? Something similar?
Yeah, so Speaker Mike Johnson has a couple of options when it comes to passing a Ukraine aid package through the House. One is, as you mentioned, the Senate aid package that was already passed in February. That's a $95 billion package that includes $60 billion for Ukraine, as well as some money for Israel and Taiwan and some humanitarian money as well. There's another option that has been floated by a bipartisan group of House members that would be a smaller package, about $66 billion, and would have military-only funding for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, as well as some border security measures, which is kind of a play to try to get some Republicans who are generally hesitant to send more money to Kyiv on board with the bill. And then Johnson recently indicated that he might even pursue a third potential avenue, which is likely going to be a more similar in nature to that second proposal, that $66 billion package, with some potential amendments that might, for example, make the money to Ukraine as a loan rather than as, you know, rather than just giving it to Ukraine without any sort of strings attached. There's also some proposals to redirect assets that were seized under Russian assets that were seized under a separate law and try to redirect them to Ukraine, although there are some potential legal liabilities with that. So there are a few different options he can explore, but of course, Democrats would prefer to just simply pass the Senate aid package that already made it through the upper chamber in February. So, but that, of course, might raise the hackles of some hard right Republicans. So Johnson kind of needs right. to figure out a way to navigate through the situation.
Okay, well, so talk about those far right Republicans. Who is pressuring him not to fund Ukraine?
There's a number of hard right Republicans who are very hesitant to send more money to Kyiv. But right now, his biggest concern is Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. She is a hard right Republican, and she right before the House recessed last month, she introduced a motion to vacate the chair, which as we remember from the downfall of the former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, that is a motion to remove the House Speaker. And if she did, when she introduced that motion, she did stop short of forcing a vote on the matter. But she's indicated that if Johnson moves forward with a Ukraine aid package, she might actually change her thinking on that. And it may actually push her to demand a vote on the motion to vacate. And so he is facing the threat of a potential ouster if he does move forward with the Ukraine aid package. That being said, there are also some members of the House Republican Conference who are increasingly in demanding that the House does need to take a vote on Ukraine because they're concerned about the fact that Ukraine is running out of ammunition, it is running out of resources, and they see that that is a potential opening for Vladimir Putin.
Mm. Well, is there anyone else from the far right flank who has said that they will go ahead and vote to vacate the chair, that they would side with Marjorie Taylor Greene, or have they kind of, so to speak, held their fire? At this point,
they seem to be holding their fire, but I think that calculus could really shift again, depending on what Johnson does on Ukraine aid. If you remember back to the fall when the hard right Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida pushed for the removal of Kevin McCarthy, one of Gaetz's biggest concerns was that he felt like McCarthy was working too much with the Biden administration to get more money to Kyiv. And so if we see Johnson, you know, take a similar tact and either take up the Senate aid package or try to advance a, you know, similar but maybe slightly smaller aid package that still includes money for Ukraine, then we might see some of the Gaetz type folks start to move in the direction of pushing for a motion to vacate. That being said, you know, prior to the House recess, I have some reporters ask Matt Gaetz about their thoughts on the motion to vacate. And he basically said at that point in time that he was hesitant to back it, in part because Republicans have seen a series of resignations from their conference recently, people who have decided to leave Congress rather than finish out their term. And that has kind of changed the math for them because they already were dealing with such a narrow majority. And with those resignations, it's becoming even tighter and tighter, which could, in theory, potentially create an opening for the House Democratic the House Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, to maybe come in and cobble together some kind of coalition government.
Oh, wow. Really? What would that look like?
It seems pretty unlikely at this point, but basically I think that the concern among some Republicans is that if we got into a situation where Mike Johnson was, removed from his role, if there were enough Republicans to, kind of kick him out of that top job. And then, as we saw last fall, what happens then is basically the House comes to a complete standstill and they are unable to do any business until a new speaker is elected. And given how much trouble Republicans had in cobbling together the necessary votes to get Johnson elected after McCarthy's removal, I think there is some concern that if there is a sort of a similar protracted standoff, then maybe a couple of the the more centrist members of the House Republican Conference might kind of like throw it Jeffries' way. To be clear, at this point, that seems like a remote possibility. But, given how close the math is, it is not, I would say, it is still not a possibility that is at zero.
Right. Because soon the Republicans will only have a one vote majority, correct?
Correct. Yeah, I think because the math is kind of tricky. I think right now they have a 2-seat majority. Yeah. But yes, another member is going to be leaving in the coming week and a half or so. And so, yes, the math is getting incredibly, incredibly difficult for them. And another added complication here is the fact that recently the bills that the House has passed, they have passed them under this mechanism called suspension of the rules. And under that, using that mechanism, it means that in order to pass a bill, rather than the simple majority that you usually need in order for passage in the House, it increases that threshold to 2/3 majority. So in order to get a Ukraine aid package across the finish line, assuming that Johnson a suspension of the rules, which he has indicated he would need at least roughly like half of the House Democrats to get on board with it as well. And that doesn't even take into account the fact that many House Republicans will probably vote against a Ukraine aid package. And so the math is already so difficult. And then you increase the threshold to 2/3. And if you really see how much Johnson is going to have to rely on Democrats' help here if he wants to get a Ukraine aid package through the chamber.
Well, how desperate is he to do that? Is that really at the top of his agenda, or would he prefer to do other things?
That's a great question. I think that's kind of been something that both Ukraine allies and Ukraine skeptics have been kind of trying to piece together. There's the speaker, Mike Johnson, he kind of gives this impression that anytime that he speaks to somebody, when that other person walks away from the conversation, they always have the sense that he agrees with them. And yet, because he seems to be always giving the impression that he agrees with whoever was that he spoke to last, it can sometimes be hard to get a decent understanding of where he stands on any individual issue. I will say that with Ukraine aid, it seems like he has increasingly been moving he's embracing more the idea of trying to advance a package because he is starting to hear from some more of his members who are really deeply concerned about Ukraine's position in the war. The White House has been warning for months at this point that Ukraine is really in a dangerous position, that they are running out of resources. And that was true at the end of last year. And now, the situation has become only more dire, I would say, for Ukraine. And if more funding isn't approved in the immediate term future, then we could really see a situation where Russia is able to advance significantly in this war. And I think that that reality and that sort of the crucial timing that we're dealing with here has really dawned on some members of the House Republican Conference and by extension on Johnson himself. When the Polish prime minister was in D.C. last month, he directly spoke to that and said, see, really called out Johnson and said, you need to realize that this is about more than just, Washington politics. There's people around the world who are looking to see what you are going to do on this because it could determine the future of not only Ukraine, but of much of Eastern Europe as well. And I think that the stakes of that and the weight of that is really starting to break through to Mike Johnson. So even though he has voted against some Ukraine measures in the past, it does seem like he wants to do something here.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That's Joan Grieve, senior U.S. political reporter for The Guardian, who is based in Washington. Joan, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, our Legal Eagle is here to talk about Trump lawyers facing possible disbarment. And a little later, we will assess the latest and final season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's all ahead next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. Another of Donald Trump's former lawyers has been reprimanded for his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Jeffrey Clark, a former acting assistant attorney general, was charged last week with ethics violations for his scheme to get Trump to stay in office. He now faces disbarment by the D.C. Bar Association. A similar thing happened to lawyer John Eastman here in California last month. In total, nearly a dozen lawyers associated with Trump have faced various legal consequences while representing him. Joining me now to talk about all this is Jessica Levinson, our Legal Eagle and professor at Loyola Law School. Hello.
Hello. Here we are again.
Here we are again. Okay. Remind us who Jeffrey Clark is and his role in the efforts to overturn the 2020 election.
So Jeffrey Clark worked for the Department of Justice. The reporting indicates that really his area of expertise was environmental law. He rose through the ranks in part because I think Trump saw that he was somebody who was trying to help Trump. And what he did essentially was espouse that the Department of Justice should send a letter to say, we think there's something fishy with the 2020 election results, and in fact, kind of give cover to certain Republican state lawmakers to say, send a alternative slate of electors to the Electoral College, or just don't send the slate. Essentially, what he was trying to do is use the power of the Department of Justice, use the credibility of the Department of Justice to send a letter that would then allow state lawmakers to say, maybe we shouldn't send our electors. Maybe this state actually didn't go for Joe Biden. Now, the letter was never sent. The attempt was thwarted, but it appears to be a very real attempt nonetheless.
Right. So his superiors said, no, thank you. We're not going to do that. And I think they threatened to resign en masse if that was sent out, that letter under the name of the DOJ. So he, Jeffrey Clark, was found by the D.C. Bar Association that he violated his ethical duties, that there was an ethics violation there. What does that mean?
That's right. So it means that lawyers, unlike a lot of other people, and I know there are entire cottage industry when it comes to jokes about lawyers, but lawyers are held to a different standard than some other professionals in our society. And the idea is that we hold positions of power and we hold positions of trust, and you can't abuse that position. And so, as you mentioned in the introduction, there have been about a dozen lawyers who've espoused a variety of different strategies, sometimes in court, sometimes in this case in the Department of Justice, to try and allow Trump to hold on to power. Now, you're allowed to promote legal theories that stretch the current law that maybe most people don't agree with and are held in the minority, but you're not allowed to use your position of power and trust to do things that are just not grounded in reality, where there's no facts or law behind it. And that's why you see Jeffrey Clark subject to the DC Bar Association saying there was no there when you were trying to push to thwart the peaceful transfer of power. That's why you see a California judge, when it comes to John Eastman, saying when you drew up that now famous memo to try and say that Vice President Mike Pence had the power not to certify the Electoral College vote, you were abusing your position of power and trust. You know, we can go down the list to talk about Sidney Powell, talk about Rudy Giuliani, but that's what it all comes down to in all of these cases.
Right. And will these lawyers be eventually disbarred, do you think?
So I think some will. When it comes to Jeffrey Clark, this is a preliminary finding. It's non-binding. When it comes to John Eastman, a California judge has said that he should be disbarred. Now he can still appeal up. That's not final. When it comes to Rudy Giuliani, same thing. We're in this kind of temporary holding pattern where an initial panel has said, we recommend that he lose his bar license. There were issues, again, with respect to Sidney Powell in a variety of different states that I think we talked about a while back. I think it's entirely possible that one or many of these attorneys lose their bar license, which I think we should remember is really a nuclear option. I mean, you certainly have lawyers who face sanctions, but typically you would face maybe a temporary sanction where you can't practice and you have to go inactive for a certain period of time. But this is saying we're kicking you out of the club. You're off the island. We cannot tolerate even your ability to come back in 1 or 5 years. That's kind of how egregious these bar associations think this conduct is.
Well, it happened in Watergate and some lawyers actually went to prison. So it is possible. So speaking of, these three are also facing criminal charges in the Georgia case, right? Clark, Eastman, and Giuliani.
That's right, for very similar conduct. Now, not always exactly the same, not completely overlapping, but in this case, we're not talking about do you get to keep your law license and where will you face professional sanctions? Instead, we're talking about do you get to keep your freedom at all? Will you, in fact, be convicted of criminal charges? And that's something that, as you said, happens in a criminal court. That involves the Georgia case, which is a fairly sprawling and big RICO case dealing with efforts to try and undermine the election. But it all comes down to the same thing, lawyers and others trying to undermine a valid election. And in some cases, we're saying the repercussions are professional. And in some cases, we're saying the repercussions might be criminal convictions.
Okay, moving on to another federal case that Trump is facing involving the classified documents that were found in Mar-a-Lago after he left office. He's charged with 32 counts of violating the Espionage Act. And there has been a spat between the prosecutor in this case and the judge, Eileen Cannon. So talk about what happened there.
So the prosecutors have had a number of spats, I would offer, between themselves and Judge Cannon. The latest one involves the argument by the former president that this case should be dismissed based on the Presidential Records Act, which is a statute that he's not charged under. He's charged under the Espionage Act and the obstruction statutes. And he's trying to argue, well, I just made everything my personal property, and so you can't charge me in a criminal court. The prosecution has said I'm paraphrasing here, but that's akin to something like you're charged under the Violence Against Women's Act and your defense is, well, I paid my taxes. They're just two totally different federal statutes. And that's ultimately what Judge Cannon concluded here, at least with respect to Trump's motion to dismiss. She said he's not charged under the Presidential Records Act. It doesn't apply at this point. But then she left the door open for him to argue when and if this case goes to trial, that to bring forward his Presidential Records Act argument again. And that's the current fight between Jack Smith and the judge, where he's saying, if you really think that's true, then make a ruling now so I can appeal immediately to the 11th Circuit because you're wrong. And that's where we are today. We're waiting for her to rule on jury instructions, basically telling us, can he make this argument before a jury?
Well, there is no jury. And no trial date set. So
that's right.
I was kind of putting the cart before the horse there. Any idea when this trial could start?
Everybody loves this answer. It depends. Depends what happens in New York, what happens in Georgia, what happens in D.C., and of course, what happens in the Supreme Court. We're waiting for them to weigh in on presidential immunity.
All right. Our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, Rory Kennedy will be here to talk about her new documentary on the Santa Monica rehab group, Synanon. And we will talk to her about her brother, RFK Jr., and his presidential campaign. She is against it. Coming up, we'll look at the 12 seasons of Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, with last night's finale paying homage to Seinfeld.
He's George. We all know that he was the inspiration for, he based the character George on himself. But now, of course, George is worth $100 million.
That conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Curb Your Enthusiasm, the iconic HBO comedy starring misanthropic malcontent Larry David, came to an end last night. And if you haven't watched it yet, here is your last chance to turn away before we delve into spoilers. The entire episode, really the whole season, called back to the controversial finale of Larry David's earlier creation, Seinfeld. Larry on trial with a parade of aggrieved minor characters from the entire series' 25-year run testifying against him.
Spite store.
I was unfortunate enough to be on a ski lift with the accused.
Killed my beautiful black swan
and gave me COVID.
He tinkled on it. He sprayed Jesus.
You've seen the big piles of shoes in a Holocaust museum.
What kind of monster? Take some of those shoes out of there. And where's them?
And I will not tolerate corruption from Trump, Putin, or Larry David.
We're going to talk about the finale now with two guests. Bill Wyman is a writer and former arts editor for NPR and Salon. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how are you, Madeline?
Great, thanks. And Boris Kachka is with us as well. He's a writer and former books editor for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Boris.
Hi, Madeline.
So ultimately, again, spoiler alert, Larry is found guilty of violating a Georgia election law. He's sentenced to a year in prison. And then none other than, of course, Jerry Seinfeld comes in to save the day when he sees that a juror who is supposed to be sequestered is out in public.
I tell the judge. Judge calls a restaurant. They look at the security footage. Mistrial declared. Sentence thrown out. You're done.
Crazy.
You don't want to end up like this. Nobody wants to see it. Trust me.
Okay. So, and then they kind of call back to the Seinfeld finale, like maybe we should have ended it this way. Bill, what did you think?
I actually thought that the final episode was a little bit of a return to form for what was otherwise a very disappointing last season. Every single sentence in the last episode calls back to that final episode of Seinfeld as well. There are all sorts of little touches that I think Seinfeld fans would be really delighted in as well. And obviously this has been a recurring thing for him because a lot of people have said that it was an actual poor finale of Seinfeld over the years. I totally disagree. I thought it was brilliant, but he obviously wanted to settle some scores here in the last episode of his second show.
Boris, what did you think?
I agree. I probably am not as down on this season as Bill is in general. I thought this episode was great. I think it really showed us that the genius of the show has always been the plotting underneath the improvisation. And, after watching the finale, you realize, oh, this is the only way it could have ended. It fits perfectly.
But I have to say, having watched this season as well, you could see how it was going to end from the very first episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really agree. It was one of the fun things about it, that in that very first episode, turning that around, you go, okay, I get it. Larry's going to go on trial. And that actually made you kind of feel a little optimistic in the first episode.
But Bill, you then ended up having your hopes dashed this season.
I really did. I'm such a big Seinfeld fan. I think when you consider that it did what it did in the 22-minute broadcast television format, it's misanthropy, it's nihilism, it's view of humanity, the devolution of the human race, and particularly the masculinity of current society. I just thought it was such a brilliant show, and it was so uncompromising, right? We've all heard there's no hugging and there's no learnings in Seinfeld. And Curb has always been such a hilarious conception because he's George. We all know that he was the inspiration for, he based the character George on himself. But now, of course, George is worth $100 million. So it changes his interaction with the world immensely. And that's where I think the humor of Curb came. And there's a whole bunch of misanthropy in that as well. But I really thought that just the mechanics of the comedy, just completely the bottom fell out of the show this season. And I don't mean there were some misfires. I mean that almost every single episode had about 5 comedic misfires. And I really can't think of a show that went so badly in the last season, except for perhaps The Wire.
Yikes. Well, why do you think that is? Why do you think that it misfired so egregiously?
I don't know.
And I agree with you, by the way. I don't think it was that funny. And I thought it was very predictable in many ways and cringy in many ways, too.
It really was. They have this huge. I mean, it's supposed. It's famously improvised. But you look at the all that list of executive producers at the end. I assume that's his equivalent of his writer's room, and you just get the sense that people just weren't fixing things. Just a good example from the first episode, if you recall, he goes to Atlanta to make a personal appearance at this guy's house, and the guy had said he's African, but he gets there and turns out he's South African and he's white. Now, there's so many things wrong with that. Like, why is Larry going to Atlanta for a personal appearance? He doesn't like going to his friend's house for dinner. You know, he has so much money. Why does he even do that? And then the whole issue of the guy being South African versus African, we never see it happen. We hear it secondhand. So you don't get the setup. And then finally you go, well, why would a white South African guy say that he's African? It just, there's so many easy ways to fix it. It just felt like there was nobody in the writer's room saying, look, we got to make this make sense.
Yeah. Well, it made me think of a much more funny kind of mistaken identity episode from years ago. And that was the Survivor episode, where a real Holocaust survivor meets a contestant on the reality show Survivor.
Yeah. Listen, where's the other survivor?
Is that a tall guy over there?
He's from the television show. Survivor?
You know, there's all this confusion about who's the real survivor. Boris, what did you think of this last season, and what were its highlights or lowlights for you?
Well, now that I think about it, I think the highlights were the parts that carried over from the last season, like anything that Irma was in, I thought worked pretty well. And, you know, I agree that there were some, you know, I think part of the problem is with expectations. I mean, when you see the lawn jockey in that first episode and you immediately know what's going to happen at the end, I think part of it is that it's become like a little bit predictable, and that clockwork plotting is something that we've been so conditioned to expect that by now there's little left to surprise us. And but yeah, comedically, I think it was generally looser than it has been, and you can see the seams starting to show.
All right, well, let's go back in time to a happier moment. Or a funnier moment, let's put it that way. This is the iconic episode from season 8. It's the Palestinian chicken episode. And in it, and I'll play the scene now, Larry and Jeff are in this restaurant. They love the food, but it's run by Palestinians. And there is a lot of anti-Israel decor on the walls.
Probably the only Jews ever walked in here.
Ever. What these people should do is send their chicken over to Israel.
For the peace process.
Mm-hmm.
They take down all those settlements in the morning, believe me. You know what? This would be a fantastic place for Jews who are cheating on their spouses to come to.
Right.
Because no Jews ever come here. They'd be so safe.
No one you know is going to ever see you here.
You would never get caught.
Ever.
Okay, so then the chicken place opens up in another location next to a Jewish deli, and there are protests, and Larry's caught in the middle. And Boris, how do you think this episode hits now? You know, here we are in the middle of a war in Gaza. Do you think it hits differently now?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, the more serious the background issue is, the more the frivolity of the show stands out. And that friction is part of what works so well comedically. But, you know, I live in Santa Monica, and I have seen protests from both sides on the same day. You know, there was an Israel rally out on the pier, and then I was driving out to Westwood, and there were Palestinian protesters blocking traffic. You know, it's obviously deadly serious, but you know, I don't know. Like, maybe sometimes we all feel like the Larry meme at the end about a lot of things, but especially about an issue that's so complex that you have to just shrug your shoulders. And I mean, looking back on it, of course, yeah, there are stereotypes that are played off of, but I think it's a pretty even and very carefully calibrated one. And I don't know, it resonates even more for me.
Well, speaking of real places and the idea of Santa Monica as actually a character in this. You wrote a big piece on this in the Washington Post a few weeks ago, and you called this part of the city the quote-unquote curb belt. So how big is the curb belt? Because it seems very small on the show.
It's pretty small. I mean, you know, we're in Santa Monica right now. I mean, there are parts of it that are diverse and, you know, somewhat. But I think if you're looking at those giant, enormous houses smashed up against each other, you know, it's not Beverly Hills, you know, it's not sprawling, but just very, very comfortable neighborhoods and sort of going up to Pacific Palisades where they film a lot of the episodes. It's just a very lush, comfortable place. And it was really fun to dig into that sociological aspect of it, because I think of him evolving from Seinfeld to Curb. That is kind of, you know, Larry's journey, where he grew up in Shipshead Bay. He was going to be a limo driver, or maybe a mailman. And then, you know, he gets to a place where, like, you don't, all your striving has ended pretty much. And yet you're still the same crank that you once were. And I think the Curb Belt is kind of full of people like that, and it makes it kind of lovable and hateable all at once, which was kind of what I was thinking about. And, you know, it obviously has resonances. I mean, we all feel like Larry sometimes, no matter where we live. But if you live here, it hits home a little bit.
Well, actually, literally for KCRW, because right down the street is one locale in a famous episode that is set in this restaurant called Teatro.
I don't know. Something strange going on in this restaurant.
Tell me.
Am I crazy? Or is everyone in that section way better looking than the people in this section? Look around.
You are not imagining things.
And now look here. It's like there's a good-looking section and an ugly section. What is
this?
You
think it's random? Why would they do something like this?
It just seems it can't be a coincidence.
I'd like to come here again without you guys.
You know, who knows? Maybe if I came here by myself, I wouldn't be sitting here.
Why do you think you shouldn't be here?
Because I know I should be in that section.
You look like Einstein's gardener, for Christ's sake. You're never going to get in there.
So who wants to
bet? If I come with you, I bet they keep you.
This is hilarious. And that's Richard Lewis, who, you know, sadly died during the airing of this season. And so, Bill, talk a little bit about Richard Lewis and what he brought to this show.
Yeah, he really did. And Larry David, he did bring his friends in. Obviously, he hooked up with Jeff Garlin at some point, who's been a great asset to him. You can actually sense the genuineness of the affection of him and Richard Lewis throughout. And he always, always did a good job. And that whole passage reminds me that we have to remember that Seinfeld, people forget this, was a great social satire, one of the greatest of our era. Curb is also a great social satire. And there are all these little thematic threads throughout it. And one, of course, is how Jeff and Larry basically become young children. They're like two little bad boys. But so when they go to the Palestinian restaurant, of course, being Jewish, they've actually, you know, they've sort of thrown over their heritage for this, you know, this evanescent little bit of good eating, right? And of course, that's another Seinfeld thread where all of our societal deeply held things now seem to go out the window just for the smallest little initial bit of gratification. And as I think you've said before, Madeline, that restaurant is so LA and it's so believable. And if I can be cranky again about the last season, if you remember, there's a whole other half an episode about a restaurant where they changed the menu from breakfast to lunch. I don't know if you remember that one. On and on and on. And you just go, you know what, guys? Is that one of the failings of it was that it just felt like they had nothing left to complain about anymore. And they're just scrabbling around for, oh, don't you hate it when you go to a restaurant? It's no longer doing breakfast. And it's like, wow, is that the biggest thing now in your life that your social, that your gimlet-eyed look at society has come down just to some poor guy trying to run a restaurant and maintaining his kitchen the way he needs to. But the ugly section is one of the great conceptions in American humor in the last 10 years, I think, I have to say.
Well, I will say the breakfast lunch, I think that's at the Gulf Club. And maybe it's a personal bias, but I just think there was way too much golf in this season.
Oh, agreed. Yes.
And, you know, and other seasons too. But, you know, but the specificity of place with Teatro is the contrast to that, and of course Palestinian chicken, but you know, Teatro in actuality an Asian fusion restaurant with very equitable seating arrangements, but I have spoken to people who and asked them, you know, have you ever seen this kind of thing? And they're like, yeah, I mean, there's always like Instagrammers up front, you know, with their selfie sticks just sitting there, and maybe they ordered a croissant at the coffee shop, but they're just allowed to sit there for a long time. It's so very LA.
And can I mention one other thing? There's also this great reference to Woody Allen's, I think it's Stardust Memories, right? Where he's in black and white on the train, where he's in the train car with all the people who look very sad and decrepit. And then the other car, Sharon Stone, all these people are having a great big party. And I thought it was a definite callback to that as well.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, there's a lot of Jewish humor in this that, you know, is it a direct or an indirect callback to other Jewish comedians, for sure. Well, I thank you guys, if I may. This was pretty, pretty, pretty good. So thank you.
Madeline, it's so nice. Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Bill Wyman, writer and former arts editor for NPR and Salon, and you can find his take on the final season in Slate. And Boris Kochka is a writer and former LA Times books editor, and you can read his piece about how Curb Your Enthusiasm portrayed Los Angeles in the Washington Post. On Press Play, speaking of Larry David, Diego, a puppet created by the YouTube star Rudy Mancuso, takes his inspiration from Larry David, and Rudy Mancuso has a new movie out. We'll talk about it next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Musician and actor Rudy Mancuso has a condition known as synesthesia. It's the blending of the senses. So imagine hearing colors or tasting sounds. In Rudy's case, everyday sounds transform into layered rhythms and melodies, whether he wants them to or not. It can be beautiful and it can be frustrating. And he explores that dichotomy in his debut film, Musica. And Rudy Mancuso joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for pronouncing synesthesia correctly.
You're very welcome. So your movie is about a guy named Rudy. He's a Brazilian-American musician, such as yourself, who lives with his mom in the Ironbound section of New York. That's the old Portuguese section. So how much of this is really based on your life, this movie?
Quite a bit. I want to say 80 to 90% of what you see in the film is true. Some version of the pieces in the story happened to me in my real life. It was about a decade worth of experiences boiled down to a 3-week or so cinematic timeline. But yeah, quite accurate. Everything from the situations perpetuated by Rudy, myself, to the condition, to the Brazilian-American experience, to my mother playing my actual mother, to me playing my actual self. Mm-hmm. It's all as authentic as I could make it.
So he's a puppeteer. He performs in the subway, and he has this puppet named Diego that his alter ego. Is that right?
Yeah, one could say that. Diego the puppet represents, I guess, a version of Rudy's unfiltered consciousness.
Okay, we have a clip of him at the puppet, which I guess is Rudy voicing the puppet. So I just want to play that.
What the hell are you doing? Playing hide and seek?
Shh, no, I sometimes have to get away from the noise, you know?
Well, that noise is a part of you, bro.
Yeah, I just don't like talking about... Why am I talking about this with you? You're a puppet.
Whoa, it's okay to be vulnerable. Everyone needs someone to open up to.
Who do you open up to?
What do you mean? I have my own puppet.
You do?
No, bro. A puppet with a puppet? That's ridiculous.
Okay, so talk about Diego, because also in real life, you have a pretty massive YouTube following, or he does, Diego the puppet. And he kind of looks like, I mean, how would you describe what he looks like? He looks like a Muppet. He's this kind of middle-aged guy with a mustache. Is that right?
Yeah, he's like a middle-aged mustache, ethnic, ambiguous puppet with a heavy Hispanic accent, and he's kind of like a culmination of people that I grew up with, family, friends. I started creating videos when I was young with these puppets that I asked my mom if I could order, and once I got the puppet bases, I manipulated them and cut them and started this Diego character, which is almost like a Hispanic Larry David of puppets.
Yeah, because he's kind of irritable all the time.
Yes, irritable, cranky, angry, and annoyed at the world.
And were you really performing busking, like on the streets and in the subway?
Absolutely. I would do these little performances on subways and train stations, on NJ Transit platforms. I'd bring my little MIDI keyboard or battery-powered keyboard, and I'd perform piano songs, puppet shows, you name it.
Wow. All right. So throughout the film and early on in the film, you see you have a scene of how you hear the world. Like, so he's in a diner with his girlfriend. You are, Rudy is. And all of a sudden, the waitresses and the cooks and everything, they start dancing and everything starts making music. Like the cook cooking, that becomes a beat. And there's just all of this sound that becomes music. And I have a clip here that I can play, which is a scene where this happens in the park later. And so I'm wondering if I could play it and you could narrate what we're seeing as we're hearing the music. So here it is.
Sure.
Do you hear the bounce?
Yes.
Listen for more.
Okay, so that's a basketball bouncing.
Yeah, so this is a moment in the film when Rudy and this new found interest, Isabella, sit at the park, and he attempts to explain to her the best he can, for the first time ever, how this synesthetic perspective really works and what it means. And the best way he could do that is by pointing to different miscellaneous actions in the park, like basketball players playing basketball, a group of teens jumping rope, guy climbing the monkey bars, two people playing checkers. And as he points to different actions, each one starts to organize itself into some musical instrument. And before he knows it, the whole park turns into an orchestration that is led by non-musical sounds. And although the audience is seeing it, Isabella isn't, which is kind of the reveal at the end of that set piece. As I say, did you see that? She's like, that's incredible. I was like, you heard it, right? She said, no. And although Rudy's a little bit let down and it's a bit of a joke, the aftermath, the conclusion of the scene is Isabella telling Rudy, I don't hear it. I don't see it, but I don't need to because I can feel you hearing it. I can feel you seeing it. And it's amazing. Mm-hmm. This is not a hindrance. This is a gift.
And is that in reality how you go through the world?
Yeah. And, you know, of course, I take some cinematic licenses here. I am depicting synesthesia in a very grandiose, romantic way. In reality, it is pretty accurate, I must say. I do try to organize everyday regular sounds into some kind of musical construct. That is true. Sometimes it's a lot more intense. Other times it isn't at all. I've been able to control it and cope with it now that I'm older and I've been living with it for so long. I channel it through my creativity. There was a time in my life where I didn't have a creative outlet, and these sounds were very torturous. And the film depicts both the good and the bad.
What do you mean by torturous? You would be in a public place and the sounds would be overwhelming?
Sure. I mean, you watch the opening scene of the film. It's everything you need to know. It's extremely, the sounds are extremely distracting. I start to try to organize sounds into rhythm while I'm having a conversation with someone. And by the end of the conversation, I heard nothing they said. And it can be quite hindering.
I'm wondering how you can control it and channel it into your art rather than have it overwhelm you and become just really distracting and frustrating.
I have learned how to access it when I need to. So this perspective helps me create. I can channel it into musical ideas, into melodies. I can channel it into storytelling. For me, the dream was always not only use it to enhance storytelling, but use it as a character in the story itself. And that's the opportunity that I have with Musica. Synesthesia is very much a character in the film.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, there are a lot of non-human elements, characters to the film, the puppet, the synesthesia, the music in general. But then there are some very real humans, including your mom. As you said earlier, you cast your real mom as your on-screen mom, and she had never acted before?
Nope, she's not an actor. She's not trained. She doesn't have a history in performance. She's just very naturally, unapologetically herself, and a naturally great performer. And I had to take advantage of that in my story.
And she's like a, you know, a yenta. Like she really wants to set you up with other Brazilian girls. Is she like that in real life? Like trying to run your romantic life?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, we have a clip from the movie that illustrates this.
So you've done this before? Been set up with other Brazilians?
Of course.
Right. Yeah. So it's messed up.
I don't get it. What's wrong?
No. Yeah, what's wrong? Qual problema?
Mom, are you serious? This isn't weird to you? This whole... She's setting us up. She's sitting right there.
So? They're just trying to help us find love. Time is running out.
Verdade.
But time's running out for what?
To start our lives. Mortgages, babies, stuff like that.
Baby? Well, who's talking about babies?
So what was it like working with your mom on this film?
Oh, it was a ton of fun. I mean, her energy is palpable. It's contagious. She's naturally hilarious even when she's not trying to be. And yeah, we got to have real conversations that as mother and son, from Brazilian native to her Brazilian American son, half the sentences are in English, half of them are in Portuguese. And that's authentic to how I actually communicate with my mother. So it was fun. It was also stressful. It was also a bit traumatic. Looking back, it was rewarding.
Did you learn anything about her or vice versa when you were making the film?
I don't know that I necessarily learned anything new about her. But I think the biggest takeaway was, wow, she really steals this show. She's my favorite part of the film. From a performance aspect, I knew she was naturally a good actor, but she held her own for an entire feature film. That surprised me. I'm surprised, but not surprised at the same time. I can't wait to collaborate with her again, as long as she doesn't drive me insane.
And has she successfully set you up with somebody? Has she been successful in that part?
I don't think so. She tried her best growing up to set me up with the daughters of her Brazilian friends in the neighborhood. And it was always very bizarre. I met some incredible people in the making, but that's going to inevitably be some criticism. It's like, is this guy really have all these beautiful women after him? And the truth is, did my mother set me up with a beautiful Brazilian woman when I was growing up? Absolutely. Was it weird and uncomfortable? Absolutely. Was I dating two girls at the same exact time? Not necessarily. What Isabella and Haley represent more than actual romances in my life are different paths that Rudy can take. So where Isabella represents one version of Rudy's future, where he follows his gut and continues being creative and is a lot more present, doesn't think so much about tomorrow, thinks about now, adventurous, much more aligned with Brazilian culture. Haley represents a more individualistic personality, following the footsteps of multiple generations of Americans who went to the same school and then fell into the same line of work and career. And diversified outside of Newark and went to New York and got a more stable position. Whereas mom represents this very heavily Brazilian, keep it within the family, within the culture, within the neighborhood, stay here, live with me as long as you can. These are all three very vastly different versions of Rudy Future, and none of them are wrong, but none of them are his. And that's the point.
Mm. Right. So where did you grow up? Did you grow up in Newark in the Ironbound neighborhood?
I grew up in Glen Ridge, New Jersey. That's where my house was. That's where my mother raised me. That's where we shot in the actual movie. But we spent a great deal of time, all of our free time in Newark, in the Ironbound. That's where I went to eat. That's where my mother went to buy groceries. That's where all our family friends were. That's where I ultimately went to school and college, as you saw in the film. So I identified very much with that neighborhood, much more than I did Glen Ridge.
And now does it feel like home to you?
Well, it's changed quite a bit, right? It's more gentrified now. Mm-hmm. But till this day, I go to the same restaurants I grew up in. And every time I'm there, whether it's taking the train or driving by or walking the Ironbound streets or going to the fish market with my mom or going to Brasilia Grill to eat, it's extremely nostalgic. And I feel right back to, you know, 15-year-old Rudy.
Well, congratulations to you and the movie. And that's super fun. And I appreciate you being here.
Of course. Thank you so much for the great question.
Oh, it's my pleasure. That's Rudy Mancuso, co-writer, director, composer, and star of Musica, which is streaming now on Amazon. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at KCRW. I'm at the Mad Brand. Of course, our podcast is free and you can download that at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. Coming up, petunias that glow in the dark are a thing now. The genetically modified flowers actually generate their own light. You'll hear about that in the next hour on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again tomorrow.